This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Steepen. He's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, interesting one today. We're devoting the whole podcast to a person that we've spoken to a number of times over the years, had an incredibly interesting life and plays a major part in the outdoor scene in Scotland.
Heather Morning, she spent a lifetime working in the Scottish outdoors and outdoors all around the world, really. She's a mountain safety advisor in Mountaineering Scotland. She makes it her mission to try and communicate to folk how to avoid accidents. She's had a fascinating career, as you'll hear, well, which is why we wanted to take some time out to talk to her. And it was a pretty rough day, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty wild, kind of sleet and hail and rain, but despite the weather, and, you know, she's tough, she's used to that kind of thing.
We're not.
But first of all, we wanted to know what our current job actually involves.
If you had to summarise the job, it's basically looking at why people get into difficulties in the mountains and providing education and training for people to get the skills to operate safely. So it's very much not a guiding service. It's about giving people very accessible opportunities, both financially and geographically, to learn the skills to go and enjoy the hills. I was brought up here on the North Yorkshire Moors, and my parents were super keen hill walkers, and Dad was a climber. Dad was doing the Munros, so before I could walk, I was carried around in a little homemade seat, because back in the 60s, of course, there weren't all these kind of fancy child carriers. For family holidays, we came to Scotland. I think I'd probably done about half the Munros before I even knew what one was.
You develop this love for the hills because you're getting either hauled about or dragged up or held by the hand and taken up Munros and things. When you left school, was it to work in the outdoors?
Interestingly, I was brought up in the northeast of England in the 80s, and throughout my whole school life, girls were trained to be secretaries and typists. I actually did 5 years at school clonking away on those really old-fashioned typewriters, which amazingly, you know, in our modern world has proved to be very useful. I left school at 16 and went into work, as you did in those days. I very much thought that to go to university, you had to be kind of really super bright and, you know, there just wasn't those opportunities then. So I did actually work initially in an office for 5 years, and then I started volunteering in a youth club and I became aware of the Mountain Leadership Scheme. And I did my summer mountain leader training with Cleveland County Council, and I turned up in a pair of red plastic wellies on the North Yorkshire Moors, because that's what I wore to walk on the North Yorkshire Moors in the winter.
People did in those days. It's nothing that unusual.
Yeah. And I think that was really quite pivotal, because I realised that there was a big wide world out there, and in order to get out there and have a career in the outdoors, I needed to further my education. So I managed, after a lot of applications, to get a place at a university doing BA in recreation and community. I then went on to do a postgrad certificate in education at Bangor Uni. And then later, many years later, I went on to do a master's in sustainable mountain development with UHI. So not bad, really, from a kind of kid from a working class background.
Was there always a game plan? Was there always an end point?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of the opportunities have kind of evolved. And of course, you make opportunities for yourself as well. But if I had any end point, it was definitely to end up in Scotland, where I've been for the last 25 years now. And my first break with that was working at Plasy Brennan, the National Outdoor Centre, and we would come up and work the Scottish winters over on the West Coast. And then I saw a job advertised with Joint Services, the Mountain Training Centre at Ballehoolish. I was like, yeah, that's the job I want. That's my foot in the door for being full-time up in the Highlands. There's no doubt that thing, you know, if you're keen and enthusiastic and you're prepared to put the graft in and work hard, then doors open for you. There's no doubt about that at all.
What was it like when you got your first job in the outdoors? I mean, was that just, yeah, here I am?
Well, my first proper job in the outdoors was straight out of uni with a teaching certificate and straight into a full-time teaching post at a local authority centre, which was down in Wales, working with kids from Walsall. I did 2 years working with kids and kind of realised that probably wasn't going to be my forte. So I jacked it in and went off travelling around Nepal for a few months. And then I managed to get onto the assistant training scheme at Plasy Brennan, the National Outdoor Centre in Wales. And that really opens doors because it's not just about the training and opportunities you get, it's all about the networking and get yourself known. And I ended up staying at Plasy Brennan for 8 years.
Being an outdoor instructor is a bit like being a gunfighter, isn't it? I mean, reputation's got to do, performance has got something to do with it.
I was wondering where you were going.
Well, I'm just saying, it's here she comes, stand by.
I think it attracts certain characters, and certain characters get on in the outdoor world for sure, because it's not a profession for a shy retiring type. Obviously, it can be very challenging, both physically and mentally at times. And you're teaching, you know, you're entertaining people, you're giving people a good and safe, enjoyable experience, and you want to come back. So people need to enjoy themselves.
Not just in terms of the training and the teaching that you've done. You've actually done quite a lot of guiding around the world.
Yes, I've been really fortunate, and I've travelled and worked in a lot of different countries. For example, I did 3 seasons working down in Antarctica, guiding clients up Mount Vince. And you need to do an interview down in Antarctica.
I need to do get on that one. Yeah.
Leaning against an open door.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to.
But how do you get a gig like that? Because that is people putting a huge amount of trust in you. I mean, it's kind of a recurring theme in your whole life.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because it's not like you see a job advert and you apply for it for the job that I went for. It was very much who you know. And I'd been on Denali in Alaska on a private climbing expedition, and on the back of that and meeting some of the rangers who operate and run the camp at 14,000 feet on Denali, I then was invited back to do a season with them. And then on the back of that kind of cold environment experience, a friend of mine suggested that I would be good at doing the job down in Antarctica, and I was offered that job. Because let's face it, if you're putting people out into a harsh, challenging environment, you actually want to know that they're going to do the right thing. It's not just about having a piece of paper.
But are you comparing like with like? Leading in Scotland, is it like the same as leading in Antarctica, or do you have to learn whole new skills?
I think often it can be more challenging in Scotland in the winter, because we have such a harsh, windy environment, and this wet cold that we get, you know, with a temperature hovering around zero, is much more difficult to manage than a really dry cold where you're in your down suit and it might be minus 20, but you know it's going to stay like that. It's not changing. It's something that you can plan
get dressed,
for.
Walk out and get on with it. But how do you guide somewhere you've never been before? I can understand it, season 2 or season 3. Season 1, how did you do it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, but a lot of skills that you use in the mountains are generic for any mountain in the world. For example, on Mount Vincent in Antarctica, you're using glacier crossing skills. You know, you're crossing big crevasses, and obviously you get those in the Alps and other regions of the world, and, you know, you experience altitude in different parts of the world. So there's a lot of generic skills, and just keeping people hydrated and warm.
Well, I've been out in the hill with you in a whiteout. I couldn't see a damn thing. And you're marching across the plateau with your compass and took us bang exactly where you're supposed to go. I know you're good at that. I know that's your job. But I was quite scared, and I've put total faith in you. You're aware of that responsibility when you've got clients.
Very much so, yes. And through the Mountaineering Scotland Mountain Safety Programme, we now run winter navigation courses on the back of the fact that, you know, there's lots of call-outs because people get caught out because it's dark. And it's probably one of the most challenging things that I do, because we're going out on the hill here at Cairngorm when everybody else is coming back off the hill. And as soon as you take out the daylight, it just adds to another layer of complexity and challenge. And I always call the winter navigation courses the winter epics. You know, it's not training, it's real. And there is no room for getting it wrong, because spending a night out up there, however well equipped you are, could be pretty dangerous.
Do you ever find yourself somewhere like Antarctica and resenting the fact that the clients are there? You just sometimes find yourself thinking, I wish this was just me at the moment.
Ooh, that's an interesting question, because if the clients weren't there, I wouldn't be fortunate enough to be there. You know, I would never be able to afford to go down there and do expeditions for myself. It's only because people are willing to pay for your services to be guided at Vincent that I had that amazing opportunity. And let's face it, you know, a big part of the enjoyment of being in the hills is with the people that you're with and the characters that you're with. That's a huge part of it for me.
Just concentrating on Scotland rather than Antarctica. In the 30-plus years that you've actually been involved doing this, has the nature of the risks changed? When people come into the hills, what puts them at risk? Has that changed?
I think there's been some very subtle changes, which is all about modern technology. You know, there's incidents of people calling out mountain rescue because their iPad battery has gone flat, for example, and that's at one extreme. But we all use modern technology. You know, they're great tools of the trade, and I teach modern technology now as part of my navigation classes. I think particularly with the younger generation, where their whole life is geared around technology, it's just a kind of natural progression from that to take that onto the hill. And probably the sort of traditional map and compass skills that are obviously essential are sometimes lost or not even there to start with.
Is that a hard sell to actually convince people to use them? I was speaking to a mountain rescue leader who said they came across somebody with a laptop they were navigating by.
Yes, I've heard that story as well, yes. And I'm continually, you know, running navigation courses and opportunities to train people very cheaply. And every place is full on the courses. You know, if there was more of me, we could do an awful lot more.
You also have been involved in mountain rescue. How did that come about? Why did you want to get involved?
I was very keen to get involved in mountain rescue because I'd been rescued myself out in the States when I had a fall from a climbing crag. And once I'd settled in Strathspey here, it seemed the ideal opportunity because I had that sort of stable lifestyle rather than travelling around working, to be able to offer my services to help like-minded people in the hills.
Tell me about the experience in America. What happened?
So I was a young kid on the block. I was out there travelling, and just as you do when you're that age, you just pitch up to a climbing area, leave a note on a notice board in the local climbers' cafe saying, anyone want to climb? And I was in Red River Gorge, Kentucky, met up with a local climber, and it was very soft sandstone rock we were on, and I fell. I had a piece of protection rip out because the rock was very friable and the other protection was too low for it to make any significant effect. So I basically fell from about 15 metres and hit the ground with some damage to my back. So it was a proper stretcher job, yeah.
Does that not put you off climbing altogether?
It is hard, yeah. To get back on the horse is hard, yeah. And trusting gear was hard again, and trusting your judgment. And it certainly knocks you back, but also, you know, having a bit of a close call like that, also it makes you a better climber. It makes you more cautious and realise that you're not infallible.
When you were rescued in America, did it cost you?
Yes, and it's so long ago I can't remember the bill, but thankfully I had my insurance. So, yeah, it was expensive for sure.
I know where you're going with this, and we get a lot of criticism for asking this question.
Which is basically every time winter rolls around, somebody gets rescued, and inevitably somebody pops up over the parapet and says, people going out into the hills should carry insurance in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Your view on that?
My view on that is I think the situation should remain as it is. It's free of charge. All mountain rescue teams are volunteers. You know, they choose to give up their time to go and help like-minded people in the mountains. There's often the argument about how much it costs for the helicopter service, but it's far better that the guys in the helicopters train on real-life scenarios and, you know, help out mountain rescue teams. I think here in Scotland we're also very lucky that if people are going to call mountain rescue, they do tend to genuinely need help. You certainly hear stories from south of the border, particularly in the Lake District, where, you know, there's people call for help and it's a, you know, be flippant, it's a broken nail or I'm late from dinner party. And that very, very rarely happens here in the Highlands.
You were also involved with dogs. You've got your two dogs here at the moment. You've got a black one and you've got a golden one. But you were very much involved in rescuing people with dogs.
Yes, with my search and rescue dog, Millie, and the Sada. Yeah, these two are just on loan for a week. I'm looking after them for a week through the pet stay scheme.
Well, tell me about working with the dogs in the hills. How did that come about? Why did you want to go that route?
I'd always wanted a dog and felt that at that time I had a lifestyle that I could give a dog a good life, and it seemed a really nice kind of, you know, marry into my work with mountain rescue. We didn't have a search dog on the Cairngorm team at the time, so I got Millie specifically to train for search and rescue.
What breed?
Collie dog, of course. Oh, yes. Gosh. A dog is going to cover a huge amount of ground that would need a lot of person power to search the same area. But it'd be interesting how things go. You know, quite a lot of teams now have drones. And, of course, drones won't be able to operate in super windy conditions. But, you know, in some low-level searches or on some benign weather days, I think drones are going to, you know, become more and more of a useful asset to rescue teams.
But if you've got somebody buried in an avalanche, you've got perhaps minutes of oxygen before the serious brain damage, and that's what a dog's essential.
If I was buried in an avalanche, I'd want a dog there, no doubt about it.
Why did you want to come to Scotland rather than stay in Wales?
Because of the big, wide open spaces. The lack of people, the lack of busy, congested roads. You know, I did love North Wales and spent quite a few years there. And from a rock climbing perspective, it's really hard to beat for accessibility. But my heart was always in the Scottish mountains. And I guess that was instilled from a very young age, being out on the hill with my dad. And, you know, it sounds really corny, but it's definitely, you know, going out into the hills and getting away from civilization, it is definitely where I'm at my most happy.
But it is a bit challenging because we are in the Cairngorms, in the pouring rain. It's kind of bordering between sleety, slow, slush. It's cold rain. For some people, this would be hell.
Well, that's true. It's probably an acquired taste at times, and a career in the outdoors is definitely not for the faint-hearted. I often kind of think about why so few women are involved in the outdoors, and particularly at a higher level when it comes to sort of Winter Mountain Leader and the Mountain Instructor Awards at winter level. And I sometimes think they've probably got more sense, because it can be pretty hard at times.
Why are there so few women at that kind of level?
When I started out, there were very few women who held it was the Mountain Instructor Certificate, and it's recently changed to Winter Mountaineering and Climbing Instructor. The name's changed, and there were very few back in the day when I did mine 20 years ago. And that hasn't significantly changed. It's really complex and it's multifactorial. It's very much a broad cultural thing, and it's physically demanding work, and sometimes, you know, potentially dangerous work as well. So I can see why it doesn't attract women into the
But there's nothing about being up in the hills that women can't do, though.
Absolutely not, no. A lot of it is about skill as well, and you can go a long way with you know, having that skill level.
Can I just chase this? Because I find it really interesting. It's not the physicality, because we've already established the fact that women are perfectly capable of doing it. It's not the opportunities, because theoretically they should be there at the moment. Two, have women got a different attitude towards risk? Most women.
A very easy answer is yes. And that's very much reflected with the accident statistics. I just did some research recently on the gender split in fatalities, and it's less than 10% of fatalities in the Scottish mountains are females. And again, I think it's very multifactorial, but it's not that there's only 10% of people going in the hills are women. You know, we all know that. It's, you know, much more equal than that. And I think women have a different mindset towards risk, and they'll tend to be more honest and open with the feelings, and if things aren't going well and clearly, you know, the environment around them is changing, then they're much more willing to say, hey, hang on a minute, you know, I think this is a good idea to change our route or come back another day and enjoy it.
So as a safety advisor for the Mountaineering Council of Scotland, mm-hmm. how do you encourage men to be more like women?
You could probably rephrase that.
No, I'm not going to rephrase it.
Do you need to change the approach to training then?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think, and this is a gross generalisation, I know, and there'll be people out there who disagree with me, but generally men will have a bit more of a gung-ho attitude, a bit less likely to admit that they're not quite up for the thing that they've set out for. I'm not sure how you change that attitude, because it's across our sort of culture and society, isn't it? It's much more endemic than just in a mountain setting.
Of all the areas of Scotland, because I mean, you must have covered most of it, of all the areas of Scotland, if you had the time and the resources and just the freedom to do it, where would you go? What would be your favourite area?
Somewhere where the sun's shining.
Well, certainly not with that. It's certainly not here.
Yeah, a lot of it's about the people that you're with. So, you know, every area has its own sort of beauty and challenges and very different characters as well. It's a much bigger picture than just the mountain you're on. It's all about the weather and the people and what's going on in your life at the moment. And you can have some really boring roly-poly hill, but if it's an awesome blue sky day and it's covered in amazing snow and you get a great ski, then, hey, that's your favourite hill of the day. You know, I'm in my mid-50s and the body isn't as good as it used to be. So, you know, I would love to be out on the hill every day still, but, you know, you can't do that professionally and for yourself every day. It's just not physically possible. You know, as the knees start creaking as you get older, you've got to diversify into things like biking and enjoying the hills in different ways.
So what else do you want to do? Any challenges left?
Well, yes. I've always had a hankering to go and work in South Georgia. So,
South Georgia?
I think because through my 3 years' experience in Antarctica, I was so far inland, there was zero alive apart from the humans.
No wildlife?
No wildlife, no vegetation, no lichen on the rock, absolutely nothing, because it was well inland. I've always had a hankering to go to somewhere like South Georgia, where clearly the wildlife is just absolutely fantastic.
Are you happy with the way the career's gone? Do you think you've been lucky, or do you think you actually have made this happen right from being typing away at a typewriter?
Definitely happy, like rich in life for sure. I don't think I would change anything looking back. It'd be nice if your body kind of kept pace with your mind and you could keep doing the big days that you used to, but that's unrealistic and something that you've got to get your head round. I have and am having a great career. I love it very much, and I'm very passionate about what I do because I just love being out in the hills myself.
You said earlier that, you know, I think the phrase you used was, in order to stay credible, mm-hmm. you have to stay up in the hills. You have to be putting in the miles at the same time. Inevitably, as you get older, that'll have to stop.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you've got to be realistic, yeah. And, you know, for example, I let some of my young colleagues now run the scrambling courses on Sky because there's nothing more challenging from your knees than a descent off Sky, off the cooling, anywhere.
Heather's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
And you guys, thank you very much.
Heather Morning of Mountaineering Scotland, and I love that comment of hers about, you know, you basically want your body to be able to keep up with what your mind wants to do. It's yeah. so true.
Yeah, and my mind's eye, we're on
romping
the top,
up the hill.
We're on the top of the hill. It's just getting the reality of getting up there, and at that point she's made about coming down a scree slope. I used to really enjoy it. Yeah. You know, you're jumping. So if you want that kind of, what do you call that, gneiss, that very fine...
Oh, well, I know what you mean.
The fine stuff that you get on the hill. And it's great. It's like jumping down on sand.
Yeah.
Used to bound down it. Now we've had its poles. But yeah, what an inspirational character. We've known Heather for many years now. And I've been out in a whiteout with her on the top of Cairngorm Platter. And she's just striking out.
Yeah.
And I can't see a thing.
Yeah, but she knows where she's going.
Yeah.
She's got the map, she's got the compass.
I just admire the skill, the drive, the confidence and the experience. Mm. I'm just awed.
That's all we've got time for on this week's Scotland Outback podcast. We'll be back on Saturday with yet another one from myself, Mark Stephen, him, Ewan McElroy, and the rest of the team at BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for downloading us.